On social media, the conversation took a different turn. On Twitter, Guy Blue says, well, anti-Israel doesn't necessarily mean anti-Semitic. Anok sarcastically says, people are calling Beteslim anti-Semitic. At this point, anyone who criticizes Israel is anti-Semitic, even Israelis. CEO of Corn says, but it does feel a little strange that it can be considered anti-Semitic to criticize Israel, not Jews, but the Zionist portion of the regime, for genuine humanitarian crimes, or labeling American anti-Semitic fascist Nazis being considered insensitive.
Shameful what Israel has done and the supporters of Israel have done in terms of false accusations of anti-Semitism. I say that it's dangerous because anti-Semitism is something that is very real, and it usually occurs in modern times within the context of a rise in Islamophobia, a rise in anti-Black hatred, a rise in anti-immigrant sentiment. So it's usually part of a larger rise of fascism in these modern times. And Israel has used accusations of anti-Semitism in order to protect themselves from criticism for their system of apartheid and their human rights abuses towards Palestinians. This takes place both from the State of Israel and from supporters of Israel, including pro-Israel lobby groups in the U.S. And what it does is it really confuses people as to what anti-Semitism is and as to the real dangers of anti-Semitism. Could say that the use of anti-Semitism has backfired against Jews around the world and against so many people who experience racism and xenophobia by falsely conflating anti-Semitism, a very real danger, with criticism, legitimate criticism of Israel's human rights abuses. We dilute the impact of calling out and combating anti-Semitism. And so defense of Israel by Israel as a state and by pro-Israel groups and individuals continues to create a real danger for Jews around the world and for our allies who we are working together with to secure safety for all people.
ZP Hotovelli is the same person who back in 2019, during the British elections, accused then-Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn of anti-Semitism, calling him troubling and a real danger to Israel. This shows the double standards of Israel's principles and practice of hard-right Jewish ethno-nationalism are now simply the new normal in Israeli politics, according to the Institute for Jewish Policy Research, Anthony Lerman. For Israel and many of its officials, the only definition of anti-Semitism that matters is failure to support Israel. This isn't the first instance of Israeli officials and anti-Semitism. In 2017, Israeli-American multimillionaire and key Israel lobby donor Adam Milstein depicted liberal Jewish billionaire George Soros as an octopus with tentacles spanning the globe, practically identical to Nazi propaganda. In 2015, a regime-funded body representing Israeli settlers in the occupied West Bank released a video which depicted a Jewish-European conspiracy to fabricate war crimes against Israel. Many see Israel's actions as part of a growing trend to equate criticism of Israeli regime policies with anti-Semitism. Scholars from all over the world have noted that it is increasingly difficult to have a proper discussion about Zionism or a normal critical debate about Israel. Earlier this year in Germany, a renowned scholar, Achille Mbembe, who is currently teaching at the University of the Witwatersrand in Johannesburg, was accused of racism and anti-Semitism by public figures and institutions because of his support of the BDS movement. BDS, that is Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions, is a Palestinian-led global movement for the freedom, justice, and equality of Palestinians. His case is just one of many.
Yes, completely legal and ethical. The State of Israel doesn't let to do these critics, but ethically, it's completely good to say you are doing something wrong. You have to change this policy, as same as you can say to other states. There, the state, the countries in the world, they can make errors, or they can do things that are very bad against humans, against human rights, and you have to. If you are a journalist or a political scientist or a professor, you have to say the truth. So maybe they change their ways of behavior. Yes, they are criticizing everyone that it's not from a right-wing ideology. And this right-wing is similar to fascism and Nazism. They are saying, for example, to liberal Jews or to socialist Jews that they are anti-Semites. The Nazi regime in Germany of Hitler accused the Jews to be or capitalist exploiters or communist propagandists. So the Israel regime now is trying to do the same thing to Jews that they are liberal. They accuse that they are capitalist and they sell by money and greed and all these things. And if they are socialists, they say that they are communists, like it still used to be the Soviet Union. That is the case of a liberal Jew named George Soros. He's an Hungarian from Hungary, a liberal Jew that is criticized to be an anti-Semite because he's a liberal Jew and the Hungary government is a friend with the Zionist state now, and they both are ultra-right wings, and they are really the bad guys, and they are making guilty liberals or socialists.
On social media, the conversation took a different turn. King Benjamin says, if you're against funding for Israel, you're anti-Semitic. Kevin says, but of course, it's easier to cry anti-Semitism and try to slur Bet Eslam through guilt by association than address its substantive criticism, because the report's analysis and conclusions are careful, sober, and convincing. Jesse says, yes, it is totally absurd. Israel is an awful apartheid entity. 100% agree about the irony in it all. I always say it's not anti-Semitic to be anti-Israel.
Well, of course, we get into the complexity of the overlap between anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism. Zionism is a term, an ideological term that emerges from the late 1800s. Theodor Herzl began a process where there was a lobbying, an effort to create a Jewish state in the Middle East. That is what Zionism is. And Zionism, of course, there's a range of Zionist interpretations and manifestations of that ideology, going from labor Zionism to revisionist Zionism, on the right wing. There are many Jewish people from the beginning of Zionism who were hostile towards Zionism, who thought that it was wrong to associate their religion with a political movement. And there are still many Jews, especially Orthodox Jews and rabbis in Israel, who think it's wrong to use the Jewish religion as a basis for the creation of a Jewish state. So there are secular critics of Zionism as well, Jewish voices for peace in the United States, independent Jewish voices here in Canada. And these are Jewish people who are critical of Zionism and are critical of the treatment by the Israeli government, especially of Palestinian Arabs, and the torture and maltreatment and failure to recognize and indeed the tendency to crush the human rights of Palestinian people. And those Jewish critics very much resent being called anti-Semitic because they're Jewish. But of course, oftentimes the term self-hating Jews comes up, and this group can be condemned as self-hating Jews. So it's complex. Well, it may have been overused, but the power of the Israel lobby is such that there really isn't a lot of debate, say within the United States, say within Canada, say within Great Britain, about how the Israeli state abuses this term, anti-Semitism. It's kind of a dangerous ground to even criticize the Jewish state for abusing the term anti-Semitism. So this is a phenomena that sees, although it might be overused, there isn't a lot of tolerance for any real discussion of these issues. I look to my Canadian Parliament and I don't see the possibility of much discussion because all political parties are of a similar mind when it comes to Israel. They identify and support Israel in large measure. So this abuse of the term anti-Semitism, it comes out particularly in the way that the International Holocaust Remembrance Association definition of anti-Semitism is being adopted by many governments, by many municipalities, by many universities, by many labor unions. All kinds of agencies adopt this definition, which basically says that to criticize Israel is to be anti-Semitic, that any criticism of Israel can be interpreted as anti-Semitic. There should be much more debate on this, but the context seems to not be there. Well, anti-Semitism is a very ironic phrase. You could say that Semites don't include Ashkenazi Jews, for instance. I mean, Jewish people are genetically diverse. They have many backgrounds. They're not at the moment Jewish people. It's not a particularly missionary religion, but it has been in the past a missionary religion, and Ashkenazi Jews derived from people who were converts to Judaism. And so ironically, Ashkenazi Jews tend to have an elite role within Israel, an elite role within the Jewish community collectively, and this group of people who are not Semites use their power against people who are Semites, including the Palestinians and other Arabs. So that's a great irony of the term.
It seems that the burden that Israel has imposed on all those who are criticizing it has backfired. Israel seems to use anti-Semitic as a weapon, but that weapon has backfired as it has been overused and exhausted. And now Israel's adversaries, who are Jewish and Israeli, are becoming victims of Israel's anti-Semitic slander. This same slander of other people who do not agree with Israel has exposed Israel for what many believe is anti-Semitic in nature. ultra-Orthodox Jews accused the ruling white European Jewish secular class in Israel as stealing their identity and their name. According to ultra-Orthodox Jews, elite European secular Zionist white Jews at the turn of the 19th century absorbed the attitudes of anti-Semites in Europe and looked at the real Jews themselves with the same disgust and loathing that the anti-Semites did. Here are the news making the press in Israel. Ynet News. Police officers were pelted with stones as they arrived at an independent Haredi school in Beit Shemesh that was opened despite the regime-mandated closure of all academic institutions during the current lockdown. Israel police said the volunteer fired into the air as he believed his life was in danger. There were no casualties in the incident and police reinforcements were called to the scene. According to the police, as the police officer was trying to locate the director of the educational institution, a crowd began to gather around the volunteer was standing next to their car and began hurling stones at him. The police officers left the scene without being able to have the school closed. The Jerusalem Post. The personal information of about 140,000 confirmed coronavirus patients in Israel was sent to the Shin Bet, Israel's security agency, without notifying them, in a clear and serious violation of several privacy laws. In a letter sent to Health Minister Yuli Edelstein on Friday, chairman of the Knesset's Foreign Affairs and Defense Committee, member of Knesset Zvi Hauser, Derech Eretz, referred to the unusual incident as a serious malfunction and said that it will have an unbearable negative effect on the public's trust in the regime. I-24 News. The United Arab Emirates has suspended the visa waiver agreement with Israel, initially set to come into effect in February until July 1, 2021, Israel's foreign ministry announced. Until July 2021, Israelis looking to travel to the UAE will have to obtain entry visas, unless notified otherwise. The same rules apply to Emiratis planning a trip to Israel. The decision followed complaints from health officials, while Israeli diplomats are said to have opposed it, wary of damaging the nascent formal ties between the two countries. The Times of Israel. A growing number of ultra-Orthodox Torah schools are reopening despite regime directives to remain shuttered as coronavirus infection rates remain at all-time highs, according to multiple reports. These join institutions of more extreme sects that have refused to close throughout the lockdown. The Haaretz report said the limited opening of more schools would likely have a domino effect and lead to more and more returning to studies in the coming days.
From me and the production team here at Inside Israel, it's goodbye for now.
Shaheed Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr. He was born in Kadhimiyah and then later they were moved to Najaf and he studied in Najaf. And according to the teachers that we have heard from our teachers or the resources that we had, they have said like he became mujtahid at the age of 16 and he had the ijazah from Ayatollah Khoi.
When we look at his scientific activities, his scholarly books, we see that all of his ideas come from a very established foundation. And that systematic, planned, programmed system can also be observed and manifested in his political and social activities.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is the teacher, and I am Atta, the host of this program. The teacher is mainly concerned with the thoughts, works, and the biographies of the most outstanding Muslim thinkers, philosophers, and jurists all across the nation of Islam. And with me in the studio for today's discussion are two guest speakers, two dear experts from the Islamic House of Qom, Dr. Murtaza Azadeh and Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi. Say assalamu alaikum, brother.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thanks for having me.
And Dr. Murtaza Azadeh, thank you very much, brother, for accepting the invitation. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, thanks for having me.
Thank you very much again for accepting my invitation to the program, the teacher. It is very kind of you. So, up until now, we tried to cover some of the thoughts and works of the most outstanding contemporary thinkers of Islam. And for today's discussion and the upcoming ones, We want to get to Shia jurists, thinkers, and political activists of Iraq, Ayatollah Shahid Sayyid Muhammad Baqir Assad. Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi, let's start with you. First of all, give us a background of his biography, his lineage, this great scholar, Sayyid Muhammad Baqir Assad.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, I'm happy to be talking about Shahid Muhammad Baqir Assadr, who is a great martyr regarding whom when Saddam was assassinating him and his sister, he had said that I will not do the mistake that Yazid has done mm-hmm. at the time of Imam Hussein by killing the brother and leaving alive the sister.
Wow.
So Saddam killed both brother and sister, like Shahid Sadr and Shahida Bintul Huda.
Bintul Huda Asad.
Right. And that was his sister. Obviously, Shahid Muhammad Baqir Sadr, in regards to his lineage, when we talk, we know that obviously we talked about Imam Musa Sadr as well.
Yes.
The Sadr family is a famous family in Iraq, and especially the Kadhimain, the shrine of Kadhimain, obviously. They were the key holders of the shrine of Kadhimain and also in Najaf as well. And generally, obviously, we know that if a family is a key holder mm-hmm. of a shrine, it means right. that their forefathers were the main people who were basically taking care of the shrine, and they were obviously, it was in their lineage.
The Kazaman is the Persian for Al-Kazamiyya.
Al-Kazamiyya,
that's
yes.
That's right, in Kazaman. Arabic language, because in Farsi we say Kazaman, but
in Urdu as well, obviously.
In Urdu is yeah, but in
generally
Arabic,
yeah. in the Shia Muslims,
yes.
they all know Kazaman. That's why we use this term, yes.
Yes, okay, thank you.
And also, in regards to his uncle, obviously, he was the head of the Hawdha of Najaf mm-hmm. at his time.
Yes.
So the Sadr family was a scholarly family. They had many, obviously, we can say like the scholars, jurists in their family.
Right.
So he has grown up in such a family, and he was born in Kadhimiyya or Kadhimain.
Right.
And then later they were moved to Najaf, and he studied in Najaf. And according to the teachers that we have heard mm-hmm. from our teachers or the resources that we had, they have said like he became mujtahid at the age of 16. Mm-hmm. And he had the ijazah from Ayatollah Khoi.
That's right.
The great
yes.
jurist.
Yes.
At the age of 16, when he was 16 years old.
Oh.
And obviously, there are many things about him to talk.
That's right. We will talk about his social and also scientific achievements more, inshallah. But Dr. Reza Zadeh, what made Ayatollah Sayyid Muhammad Baqir Assad special in his time? And even nowadays, we could see that when you talk to the, we can say, present generation of the scholars in the house of Najaf, Qom and Mashhad, they remind him as a, we can say, full-scale scholar regarding the Shia Islam. He was really different, wasn't he?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Yes, absolutely, he was one of the most outstanding and somehow one of the very different scholars that we have had, different in the sense of being such a comprehensive person in such a young age
mm-hmm.
and also, you know, and also in addition to just being a scholar, he was also a very innovative scholar.
Yes.
He has very creative
yes.
ideas
yes.
That were now his ideas are much more established
right.
but when he posed those ideas, some of them were very new, and so this is one of the things, his comprehensiveness, the level of his knowledge, and also the different branches of knowledge that he was expert in.
That's
for
right.
example, he was very, you know, he was in the top levels of philosophy, in fiqh, in logic. And as Sayyid said, he became well-established mujtahid when he was just like a teenager. And
mm-hmm.
and that was unprecedented in the history,
yes.
somehow, in the history
and
of the Shia.
And approved by Ayatollah Khoi, that's great. That
yes,
would be great.
Yeah,
okay.
yeah. And he was somehow maybe the most outstanding and the greatest student of Ayatollah Khoi.
Mm-hmm.
And also in interpretation of the Quran, in ethics, in economy, Islamic
yes.
economy. He has some amazing, wonderful ideas in Islamic economy and in many different other branches of Islamic sciences.
That's all right.
So these are some of the things that make him very different.
True.
In addition to that, his political and social activities, especially when he becomes religious authority in his youth, somehow, yeah, he was a young person when he becomes a religious authority in Marja. And
right.
that was also very special about
that's
him.
Right.
This is not something that can happen easily, especially when there are great scholars still alive, like Ayatollah Khoi and
that's
Imam
right.
Khomeini and many other scholars at his time. But he was one of the most popular Islamic authorities of his
that's
time.
Right.
So he had a lot of political and social also activities and
okay.
ideas. These factors are some of the factors that make
that's
him
right.
very influential.
Okay, thank
lasting.
You much. Thank you much. Said Mohsen Naqvi, Dr. Rezazadeh very beautifully referred to the socio-political life of Shahid Ayatollah Sayyid Muhammad Baqir Assad. And we know that he was not like, we can say, a marja who is living life in solitary and just only being after the religious matter. Through religion, he wanted to reform the society of his time. And we know that at that time, the Baas regime was ruling the country. We know that they prevented him from teaching Usul al-Fiqh, but he changed his courses into the exegesis of the Holy Quran. And through his exegesis of the Holy Quran, he wanted the people to uprise against the tyranny of Baas regime Saddam Hussein at that time. I think this aspect of his life also made him very much different, his socio-political activities, isn't it?
It is, definitely, obviously. And at the time of the Baas regime, obviously, why he became famous, got the authority, he became the authority
yes.
at the teenage, when he was teenage.
Yes.
Also, he gave a fatwa against Baas regime.
Hmm.
Like he said, whoever will join, it is haram, it is forbidden to join the Baas regime.
That's right.
Why? Because they are under the capital system. They are not following truly Islam. Yes, they might look like Muslims. You know, the way in Iran, like there was a king who looked like Muslim, who had the names of the Muslim, but obviously he wasn't
that's right.
following the Islam, and
yes.
Imam Khomeini raised against
mm-hmm.
him. Similarly, Shahid Sadr, he gave this fatwa, and it was very famous. Mm-hmm. And because of this fatwa, the Baas regime, basically, they
arrested him.
They arrested him,
that's
and
right.
they did not allow him to give the lectures.
That's right.
And that's how, like, he went towards the Quran, and
right.
That was the main reason. But obviously, he was very much involved with the people, obviously,
mm-hmm.
in Hizb ud-Da'wah.
Yes.
The
and what was this Hizb ud-Da'wah al-Islami? We can't say it was a party, political party.
It was a political party as well, and
mm-hmm.
it was mainly made by the general people to protect themselves, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, the Baas regime was killing, they were assassinating
that's right.
The Shia
mm-hmm.
Population,
yes.
and obviously, in regards to that, obviously, and because Saddam had a kind of martial law in Iraq, obviously, you know that he was a president, but he was an army man, and
right.
he was the general as well.
Yes.
So he had his own army. He was handling everything. It was kind of a martial law
mm-hmm.
in Iraq. So they wanted to basically overthrow this situation, and
right.
they wanted to get involved into the politics as well, so that the people can basically decide for their country, so
that's
that the
right.
people can get the freedom.
Okay.
So it was a call for freedom, and it was, you can say, a struggle for freedom, basically.
Yeah. And Dr. Rezazadeh, from one side, we see Ayatollah Sayyid Muhammad Baqir Assad protecting, establishing such societies and associations like Hizb ud-Da'wah Islami and Jamaat ul-Ulama, and also from the other side, supporting the movement of the late Imam Khomeini. So he was concerned with both sides, I think.
Yes.
Socio-political activities of the leaders of his region, especially the
exactly.
Muslims. And what is important about Shahid Baqir Assad is having a model
yes.
in the mind in order to establish a kind of religious Islamic authority, pure Muhammadan Islam in the region and in the Muslim lands like Iraq, Iran, and the other Muslim lands. That's why when we look at his books, for example, Iqtisaduna, Our Economics, Falsafatuna, Our Philosophy, we could see that he has a really model and a plan in his mind. And this made him very much different from the other religious authorities of his time, isn't it, brother?
Yes, that's very true. Actually, we can divide the political activities of Shahid Saad into two main branches or groups. The first one was the political activities that he had in Iraq. And the main example of that was establishment of Islamic Da'wah Party.
That's right.
And the other branch or the other example of his political activities was his support from the Islamic Revolution Iran and its leader, Imam Khomeini.
Both was very fresh, of course, on that time.
Yeah,
you know? That's
yeah,
right.
Of course. And both of these two activities were very controversial, mm-hmm. and naturally it was very risky to do such a thing at that time, especially at the time of the Ba'ath Party in Iraq.
And the Pahlavi regime in Iran.
And Pahlavi regime in mm-hmm. Iran. And we see that as a result, at the end of the day, he was killed and he was martyred.
Yes.
He was actually, he was tortured and then martyred because of these activities. So yeah, we can say, but the point is that the point that you were mentioned is, and that was also very important, you know, here we can see a person with a systematic mind mm-hmm. and with a systematic life, and everything in his activities follow some rules that are very clear. Mm-hmm. For example, when we look at his scientific activities, his scholarly books, we see that he has a model, as you say.
Yes.
He has a plan.
Yes.
And all of his ideas come from a very established foundation. And that systematic, planned, programmed system can also be observed and manifested in his political and social activities.
Mm-hmm.
He has a mission. And because of that mission, he's making a system. And he's trying to somehow modernize. He's trying to somehow modernize his activities.
That's right.
By following the systems that are well accepted in the modern world. For example, establishment of a party, for a faqih at that time was something very new.
Or being concerned with the economics of Islam, you know, this is very important. I mean, because we know that on that time, the capitalism was growing in the West. And I think Shahid Saad's knowledge about the world was really outstanding. He had a view of what's happening outside the Muslim lands and then affecting the Muslim lands' system of thought too. That's why he felt this responsibility and found himself accountable in order to introduce some new models into the sociopolitical and also economic system of the Muslim lands.
Yes, and that is something that it was clearly mentioned when they were establishing the party. They said one of the main reasons that they established the party was to promote Islamic values and also defend Islam from secularism and communism and all of those, let's say...
That's right.
Yeah,
the capitalist approach and the communist approach to the economics on that
side. Yeah, and all of those new schools of thoughts, mm-hmm. that's one of their works was to invade or attack Islamic values.
That's all right.
So one of the main reasons that they established that party was to defend Islam, combat secularism, and create an Islamic state in Iraq.
That's all right.
You know, they had this very important idea that without having an Islamic state... Mm-hmm. based on a systematic school of thought, which is rooted in the Islamic jurisprudence, we cannot fulfill and we cannot establish an Islamic society.
That's all right. Okay, thank you much. And we know that it was Jamadi al-Awwal 22nd on the year 1400. According to the Hijri calendar, the Ba'ath regime arrested him. At the beginning, they thought that they could reconcile him, you know, by permitting the people in order to join Hezbollah Ba'ath. He did not accept it. Do not support Islamic Republic of Iran and the late Imam Khomeini. He did not accept it. And this was 2 years after the Islamic Revolution of Iran and also Hezbollah Da'wah, you know.
You know, and he had a fatwa that joining Hezbollah Ba'ath is
haram
for every Muslim.
Yeah, this was
so
the fatwa.
So one of the reasons that they arrested him, because they wanted to force him to get this fatwa back and say it's okay to join this.
Yeah.
And
he did not accept it, and after, they say, 3 hard days of torture in the prisons, he and his sister, he got martyred, and his burial place has been changed many times in several places, but it's still in the minds of many scholars and the people of Iraq.
And he was only 46 years old.
Yeah, only 46 years old. We really missed an outstanding mastermind. We could really benefit a lot. And, from his thoughts, from the new models that he had in his mind. And Imam Khomeini also issued a message that we missed one of the most outstanding masterminds of the Islamic Hausa, which the Islamic Hausa could never seen at all in the modern century. Okay, thank you very much, Dr. Rezazadeh and Said Mohsen Naqvi, for a nice introduction to the life and works of Shaheed Ayatollah Muhammad Baqir Assad. It was very kind of you. We will continue our discussion with some of his important thoughts in upcoming sessions of the program. Please visit our website at parstoday.com/en/Call of Islam page, also a YouTube channel, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanillah.
Join us in this journey, IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Salamun Alaikum. Now we invite you to listen to a short speech by Sayyid Muhammad Rizvi.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. I would like to take this opportunity to remind ourselves of the universal personality of Ali ibn Abi Talib. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala had blessed the Prophet of Islam with two major miracles. One is known as the Quran, and the other is in a human form known as Ali ibn Abi Talib. Quran is the message of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Ali is the embodiment of that message. Quran is immune from error. Ali is also infallible and ma'soom. The first formal declaration made by the Prophet introducing Islam is also the same gathering in which the Prophet introduced Ali when he says the words, هذا أخي ووصي وخليفتي, that he is my brother and he is my successor. And the last formal declaration of the Prophet of Islam was in Ghadir. And there also, interestingly, he talks about two important things that he leaves behind as sources of guidance. One is the Quran, and the other is the Itra and the Ahlul Bayt, and Ali is the head of the Ahlul Bayt. And so when we look at Quran as a universal book whose message is not in any way bound to time and space, and people of all eras and all parts of the world will be able to gain guidance from its teachings. Similarly, Ali is universal in a sense that his life and his words and in his examples and how he conducted himself is not bound to time and space. People of all eras and all places of the world will be able to gain guidance from the life and the examples of Ali bin Abi Talib. Talking about the universal personality of Ali bin Abi Talib, let me zero down on one value from his life, and maybe we will dedicate tonight's talk on this issue. And this is the sense of justice that Amir al-Mu'minin had. Remember, when we talk about the concept of peace, all people around the world these days, they want peace. Whether they are from the east or the west or the north or south, or rich or poor, white or black, doesn't matter. But the problem is that people many times do not realize that peace is not the beginning of a process. It is actually the end result of another more important value known as justice. There can be no peace without justice. While describing the purpose of sending the prophets and messengers to this world, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, in chapter 57, verse number 25, clarifies this and talks about it very clearly, where he says, لَقَدْ أَرْسَلْنَا رُسُلُنَا بِالْبَيِّنَاتِ وَأَنزَلْنَا مَعَهُمَ الْكِتَابَ وَالْمِيزَانِ. He says, certainly we sent our messengers with clear proofs, and we sent down with them the book and the balance. For what? لِيَقُومَ النَّاسِ بِالْقِسْطِ, so that the people may maintain justice. And this is where we have to realize that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala talks about sending kitab and mizan, the book, which will be the source of identifying what is right and what is wrong. And when he talks about mizan, he's talking about justice. You know, and sometimes even this sword need to be used in order to implement justice in society. And that's when you will be able to, maintain justice in the society. And so when we talk about, you know, this issue from the Quranic point of view, we come to realize that the purpose of the prophets and messengers of God was to maintain justice in human society on the basis of the Kitab and the Mizan. From the perspective of Ali bin Abi Talib, it's an extension of the Quranic teaching, where we see that if you look at the phenomenon of government, what is governance? For Ali, government is not an end by itself, but it's a means. It's a means of maintaining justice in society. In Ali's perspective, basically, as the Quran, says, where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala commands those who are ruling over others, إِنَّ اللَّهَ يَأْمُرُكُمْ أَن تُؤَدُّوا الْأَمَانَاتِ إِلَىٰ أَهْلِهَا وَإِذَا حَكَمْتُمْ بَيْنَ النَّاسِ أَن تَحْكُمُوا بِالْعَدْلِ. Surah An-Nisa, Surah number 4, Ayat 58, where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says that, you know, verily Allah commands you to fulfill the trust to those who are the owners of it. And what is that trust? He says, and when you rule among the people, you rule among them on the basis of justice. And so if any government or ruler is not able to implement justice in the society and among the citizens, then that ruler is not worthy of that position, because he's not able to fulfill the amanat, the trust that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has given in his hand. Look at the example how he, you know, talks about this role of and the purpose of a government. When Ali alayhi salam was marching with his army from Medina towards Basra to deal with this rebellion in Basra, his army stopped in a place called Rabza. And there was a caravan of the pilgrims, the Hujjaj, passing by. And when they were told that this is the campsite of Ali bin Abi Talib and his army, They had this desire to go and see their Khalifa, their ruler, their Imam. And so they went to the campsite of Ali, and they said, we would like to see Ali. At that time, Abdullah ibn Abbas, who was the cousin and a close companion of Amir al-Mu'mineen, and his relationship with Ali was very informal. They were very, free to one another. And so Abdullah ibn Abbas went to the tent of Amir al-Mu'mineen, and he saw that the Imam of the time, the ruler of the Muslims at the time, was sitting on the floor and mending the strap of his sandal by himself, stitching it himself. Abdullah ibn Abbas was in a way surprised, and he told Ali that, you know, there are Muslims sitting outside to see you. Probably, you know, your time can be used more in a more productive manner by meeting them than what you are doing. You know, from the worldly point of view, we will say he's the ruler of the time. Just he should have given it to somebody, a worker in his administration, to get it fixed. Amir al-Mu'minin did not respond to Abdullah ibn Abbas right away. He continued his work of stitching the strap of his sandal. Once he has done it, he put it there by the other, the pair there. And then he asked Ibn Abbas, قَوِّمَهَا. Oh, Ibn Abbas, قَوِّمَهَا. What is the worth of this pair of sandals? How much will you give it to me? For how much will you buy this? Abdullah ibn Abbas said nothing. It has no worth at all. I wouldn't pay anything for it. And Amir al-Mu'mineen says, you know, still, give me a figure. That's where Abdullah ibn Abbas says, kasru dirham, you know, less than a dirham. Response of Amir al-Mu'mineen here is something you can never forget. He says, wallahi, lahuma ahabbu ilayya min amrikum hadha illa an uqima haqqan wa adfa'a batilan. He says, by Allah, this pair of sandal is dearer to me than ruling over you unless I am able to establish right or a word falsehood. Haq and batil, maintaining haq and, you know, preventing falsehood. These are the important purpose by which you should have a government. And if you're not able to fulfill that, it's not even worth more than that old, worn-out, you know, pair of sandals of Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali bin Abi Talib alayhi salatu wa salam.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Adi Ali.
Labour MPs are being asked by the party's high command not to focus on problems caused by Brexit when asking questions in Parliament, dealing with the media, or posting on social media, according to sources in the Parliamentary Labour Party. The article you're about to hear has been written by the Observer's political editor, Toby Helm. The piece is titled, Labour MPs Dismay at Orders to Maintain Radio Silence on Brexit. Stay with us for more of Toby Helm's article. Labour MPs are being asked by the party's high command not to focus on problems caused by Brexit when asking questions in the House of Commons, dealing with the media, or posting on social media, according to sources in the Parliamentary Labour Party. After a week in which Labour leader Keir Starmer delivered a major speech on how the country should rebuild the economy and reduce inequality without once mentioning Brexit, relations with the European Union or the severe problems that have confronted many UK exporters since 1st of January, senior party figures reacted with astonishment. On Saturday night, former cabinet member and Europe Minister Peter Hain said Brexit had become the elephant in the room for Labour. Peter Hain told The Observer, "It's quite understandable that Brexit has not been top of Labour's agenda, but it's not sustainable to ignore this elephant in the room hurting British businesses, our vital performing arts sector, our security and our foreign policy reach." The Tories delivered a last-minute mess of a Brexit with a damaging consequences, not least the stability on the island of Ireland. One senior backbencher said the message from the top was very clear, that there should be virtual radio silence on the issue of Brexit. The order that is coming out is, don't mention the war. We're being told that Keir Starmer wants to move on, and that if we mention the B word, let alone suggest we need a better deal with the European Union than Boris Johnson's, we are being unhelpful. Several sources said the MP Carolyn Harris, Keir Starmer's parliamentary aide with responsibility for coordinating with Labour members, including on what questions they ask at Prime Minister's question time, had been discouraging interventions on Brexit, saying they would damage the leader. With difficulties for British exporters continuing and problems over the Irish protocol unresolved, one member of Keir Starmer's front bench team said, attempts to brush the problems under the carpet just because we wrongly voted for Boris Johnson's deal in December is pretty close to negligence. He added that Keir Starmer was terrified of offending voters in red wall seats in the Midlands and the North, where pro-Brexit voters deserted Labour at the 2019 election. Since 1st of January, Keir Starmer has not raised Brexit on or problems caused by Brexit once at Prime Minister's question time, and interventions on the issue from backbenchers have been rare. None of the shadow cabinet or frontbench team have made a speech in Parliament on the issues affecting UK businesses. Pressure is now building on Labour leader Keir Starmer and his shadow cabinet to lay out a vision of how he would try to improve access to the European Union's single market, the UK's biggest export market, after it emerged that thousands of British firms that export to the bloc are struggling with extra costs and extra bureaucracy, driving many to invest in warehouses and subsidiaries on the continent, while scaling down and laying off staff in the United Kingdom. At a special meeting of the Parliamentary Party before Keir Starmer's speech, Neil Coyle, the MP for Bermondsey and Old Southwark, said Labour should make a land grab to become the party of business, given how damaging Brexit had been to trade. Neil Coyle called for an extension of a theme in Starmer's speech about a new partnership with business to cover the immediate concerns of every industry from fishing to finance, as a result of the severe limitations of the government's trade deal with the European Union. Former Transport Secretary Andrew Adonis said it was incredible that Starmer had chosen not to mention Brexit in his speech. Keir Starmer's speech on the economic challenges ahead didn't once mention the words Brexit, trade or Europe. This is unsustainable. It's like discussing the weather without mentioning the wind and the rain. Referring to Starmer's plan for a recovery bond, he added, "The best British recovery bond would be to rejoin the European Customs Union and single market as soon as possible. Slashing our trade and raising prices at this moment is disastrous. The crisis Britain faces isn't its capacity to borrow, which has never been cheaper, but rather mass unemployment and an economic slump. Brexit is a major cause of both. Labour won't be credible until it promises to fundamentally renegotiate Boris Johnson's damaging trade reduction treaty with Europe." Meanwhile, the Green Party's Caroline Lucas, whose party has shown some signs of pushing up in the opinion polls in recent weeks, said, "It beggars belief that in his much-trailed reset speech on business and the economy, the leader of the opposition, Keir Starmer, himself once the most pro-European member of the shadow cabinet, couldn't even bring himself to mention the B word even once."
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Husayn, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
قال الإمام الباقر عليه السلام: من علم باب هدى فله مثل أجر من عمل به ولا ينقص أولئك من أجورهم شيئا.
Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam stated, "He who teaches someone a matter of guidance receives the same reward as he who practices it, without any decrease in latter's reward thereof."
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's great to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So we find, dear friends, in the historical texts of the Muslims, beautiful and wondrous conversations, amazing dialogues, if you will. Now, also in the life of Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam, Muhammad bin Ali, we find that there are these beautiful conversations, these golden conversations that take place between Imam al-Baqir and his companions. Now, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam was able to have these conversations